Turn back to Exodus and to chapter 32, and we're going to do a tiny bit of chapter 31 as well, and we're going to see what we can learn from this incident of the golden calf. As we've said already, there they are at Mount Sinai, and they arrive there in chapter 19, we're looking at back in the spring, and they arrived at Mount Sinai, and God spoke to them the Ten Commandments. In chapter 20, God spoke all those things with a loud voice. Then after that, the people ask that God wouldn't speak to them directly, but would speak to them instead through Moses. So Moses goes up, and he gets more of the instructions. So they're told some of the things, it seems. And then in chapter 24, we thought about it a couple of weeks ago, how Moses and some of the elders go up halfway up the mountain and eat and drink in God's presence. And then the rest come down, Aaron and the elders come back down to the people, whereas Moses and Joshua head up the mountain to the top again, and they stay there, we're told, in chapter 24 and verse 18, for 40 days and 40 nights. So Moses has been getting instructions for the tabernacle. Those are the things we've been looking at in these last couple of weeks, from 26 through to 31. And then after that, after we've dealt with these couple of chapters, they're going to get on with building it. That's the whole plan. In a way, these chapters shouldn't be here, should they? It should just be simple. Moses goes up the mountain and receives the instructions for the tabernacle, and then he comes down and they build it. That's what should happen, isn't it? But Moses seems, in their opinion, to be too slow, to be delayed. And that's what they're struggling with. So they say in verse 1, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." Moses has gone up the mountain 40 days. It is quite a while, isn't it? A month and a bit. Moses has been away from them. It's taking so long. Remember, he thought it'd be a quick up and down. Moses would just come up. Oh, he'd be back down in no time with instructions for them. He hasn't come down. Who knows what's happened to him? Has he died up there on the mountain? Has he disappeared? Has God whisked him away somewhere else? They haven't got a clue. But they instantly think of those bad things, of course, that Moses isn't coming back. And they need something else instead. And before we get too hard on them, it is hard, isn't it, to wait for God? We're told that, aren't we, in God's word, Psalm 27 and verse 14. "Wait on the Lord, be of good courage, he will strengthen your heart. Wait, I say, on the Lord," says David. But we find it hard to wait. It's hard to do things on God's timing. And maybe that's true for the Israelites too, because They'd had 3 months, we did that before. It's 3 months from leaving Egypt to getting to Mount Sinai. And now Moses has been up Mount Sinai 40 days and 40 nights. So it's not awfully long since they were in Egypt. At least 4.5 months, maybe a tiny bit more if Moses has been up and down a couple of times before going up for the 40 days and 40 nights. But it's been quite an exciting time. And they had a really exciting 3 months, didn't they? Leaving Egypt. With the plagues that happened right at the beginning of Exodus. The Passover. As God put to death the firstborn of every family in Egypt. Apart from them. How the angel of the Lord passed over. And they were rescued from that plague. How they exited Egypt, how they were given supplies and all kinds of things, including some jewellery, which might come up. And they were given these things by the Egyptians and whisked out of the country. How the Pharaoh had second thoughts and sought to recapture them, but God rescued them at the Red Sea. How God led them with a pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. They'd lived through some tremendous times, hadn't they? Then God had fed them with manna and quail and given them water out of the rock. He'd given them victory over the Amalekites in the desert. Loads of things had happened. It had been an action-packed couple of months. Then they'd met something and heard something of God at Mount Sinai. But now everything was a bit quieter. Presumably the cloud and the smoke were still there at the top of Mount Sinai. where Moses and Joshua had gone up into it. So there's still something there, but not much is happening in comparison with those things. And how quickly they forget God, the unseen God. And now they quickly forget Moses, because they have been able to see Moses. In fact, they attribute lots of those things to Moses, don't they, in verse 1. As for Moses, the man who brought us out of Egypt, he's gone now. So they couldn't see God, and it seems they quickly have forgotten about him, and now they can't see Moses either, and they're plunged straight away into doubt and turmoil, and then clamouring around for something else to do. And we shouldn't be too hard on them, but can we sometimes be the same even as Christians? We can go through times of excitement in our Christian life. Perhaps it was like that when we first became a Christian, and everything was new and very exciting, and we were so thrilled with what God had done for us. But then the Christian life sometimes is a bit quieter, and then we're a bit more doubting, a bit more sort of back on the back burner. Perhaps it can be like that, something like being baptized, all the excitement of wanting to do it and it happening and something like that. And then, in the weeks afterwards, the devil thinks, oh, is that it? It's very quiet now. Nothing exciting particularly happened. And so our Christian life can sometimes be like that. Going through times of great excitement when we can see God doing things, perhaps, and we see answers to prayer, and then times when it feels to us there's a bit of a lull. And things are just on a bit of a go slow, perhaps. And how easily we can forget God, who we can't see, just like the Israelites. And they've only just been rescued from slavery. And they willfully return to slavery, don't they? Of a different sort. But in making the golden calf, which was probably the very same idols they'd seen in Egypt. They just copy some of the things they've seen before when they were slaves. What possessed them to go back, to be enamoured for the kind of things that they had in Egypt, in a land of slavery, where everyone worshipped a golden calf? That was one of the gods they had in Egypt. Now they end up with the same thing. Well, we thought of the Israelites. Well, let's think for a moment of Aaron. What a strange chap he turns out to be. He's Moses' brother. He'd been there. He'd seen the things God had been doing firsthand, at the plagues and so on. And as we looked last week, he's announced and he's been consecrated to be the high priest. He's meant to be the leader. Moses has gone up and he sends specifically Aaron down in Exodus 24 to lead the people in his absence. And if the people have any troubles, they're going to go to Aaron because he's the one who can handle it. Or he can't. Is he intimidated by the people's request? Is he threatened? He seems to suggest a little bit of that when Moses asks him about it. In verse 22, he sort of puts the onus on them. Oh, you know, they're always going astray, like you know, Moses, and so on. Aaron should be the one who leads them at this point. When they say, oh, what's happened to Moses? Aaron's the one who's meant to reassure them, isn't he? Moses has gone up to meet with God. He's definitely going to come back. He's been appointed to be the go-between. Of course he's going to come back. But now he gives up. He says, oh, bring me some gold. Maybe, some people think, maybe he's putting the stakes, oh, come on, then give us this huge amount of gold in the thought that it would wake them up. And they'll say, oh, no, we're not spending that much money on this. But they do it. So maybe it's a failed attempt to try and warn them off. Anyway, they bring the gold anyway. They willingly give it. And Aaron, we're told, sculpts it. He fashions it with a tool, verse 4, and makes the golden calf. He's the one who presumably chooses what the shape it's going to be. Aaron, after seeing firsthand all the things of God, he's the one who casts it in a mould and melts the gold and chiseled it with a hammer and the rest of it. And then he brings it out. And they say, end of verse 4, this is your God, O Israel, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. What a horrifying sentence. To the real God who had brought them out of Egypt. Now they've got some smashed up earrings made into a calf that someone's chiseled, standing there in their camp. And they say, this is the one, this is the God that has brought us out of Egypt. Maybe Stephen then, as a weak Aaron, is still trying to sort of, let's have a festival tomorrow, let's build an altar, and we'll have a feast to the Lord, Aaron says. Is he trying to remind them of the real God? Or is he trying to amalgamate the two? I said, if we call the calf the Lord, well, does that make it okay? Does that sort of combine the things we know of God and just to the Israelites are being a bit weak at the minute? So we'll just combine the ideas and we'll say it's no big deal. We'll call this the Lord too. There he is. And verse 6, so they get up early the next day. They offer burnt offerings, brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Later on it said that they're singing and dancing as well. The words are very light, aren't they, in our English translation? Sacrifices, eating, drinking, playing, singing, dancing. Which sounds a little bit like the kind of thing children do on a playground, doesn't it? But it's not. It's not those things at all. These are sacrifices they're making on some sort of altar they've concocted to a golden calf. They're not just eating, but they're gluttonously eating. They're not just drinking, but they're completely drunk. Later on it said that they're completely unrestrained. They've got no self-control. They've got no awareness of what they're doing anymore. So they're completely eating everything, eating gluttonously, drinking so much they're completely inebriated and have no control over what they're doing anymore. They're completely drunk as anything. And their playing is immoral playing. They're involved in all kinds of immorality, so much so that they say that they're ashamed in front of the other nations. They're doing the kind of scandalous things that if the other nations could see it, they'd all be horrified at what the Israelites are doing there in this drunken fest. That's what's going on. They're just given over to their senses, unrestrained. We said at least three of the commandments are broken. There could well be a lot more. Once there's a complete loss of control, are they all committing adultery? Are they lying? Are they being violent? It could be all kinds of things that go with it at the same time. It's not impossible that they could break the rest of them in this drunken state, is it? Two. There they are. And they're just copying everyone else. We mentioned before, the Egyptians had their golden calf that they worshipped. It was a representation of the god of the Nile that they worshipped. And everyone had one. Golden calves are one of the most basic idols that everyone in that neck of the woods had. Later on in the Bible, you'll find the Philistines have got the same one. And later on, when the Israelites, much later, in the time of Jeroboam, they make golden calves again. Right the way round to Hindus now in the land of India still have them. The golden calf was almost the first form of pagan worship. It was everywhere. Because it kind of made a little bit of sense in that the calf was, a young bull, was the strongest, fittest, fiercest animal in the farmyard, wasn't it? It was the most powerful beast they used. Much stronger than a horse, much stronger than a donkey. It was the bull that they used to plow their fields and to haul their carts. And it provided, it could provide animals that you then used for steak or for milk or whatever. You know, it was a very impressive animal. And that's what it all becomes focused on. That's why everyone else worshipped them. And this young, fit, strong, fertile animal that everyone else worshipped in golden form, that's what they end up doing too. So it's not even very imaginative. It's just copying everyone else in the world and the things they did. And their worship that they offer is getting drunk as a skunk, eating everything they can, and performing the kind of fertility things that all the pagan tribes did too. There it was. In the ways they behaved. And on one hand, it sounds so old-fashioned. As we said, one of the most ancient forms of paganism were golden calves. But at the same time, it's also quite modern, isn't it? Mankind still struggles to worship the invisible God. Worshipping a God you cannot see is hard, in a sense. And it's so easy to go for the cheap knockoff. To rather than worship the God who is incomprehensible and beyond the capacities of our mind, we then think, well, let's just make it a bit simpler. Let's make it a bit more tangible. Let's think of a calf, a strong, fit animal from the farm. Let's make it a bit like that, because that's more understandable, isn't it? And that's what they do. But people still do the same thing. As Paul says in Romans, we worship created things rather than the Creator. And so the calf, I'm thinking of a real calf, almost in a sense, the calf was the one that was a good gift, wasn't it? As we said, it was useful for ploughing the fields and pulling carts and using for milk or steak or whatever it was. A calf was a good thing, a strong thing, an impressive thing that God had made and God had created. And then they took something like that and made it an idol, made it the be-all and end-all of things. But we do the same thing. We take something like a car that is useful. It becomes an obsession of ours. And we spend huge quantities of money on it or something like that. A house is useful. But how easy can a house become an idol? It's all we think about. It's all we spend on. It's where our hope is. We can think the same about our career, our qualifications, good things, useful things. But they can become an obsession. They become an idol. That we put our hopes in those things, in our achievements, and not in God. We might not make something out of gold quite so daft as we think the Israelites were, but we can do the same sort of thing as everyone else. And it really is. We sometimes talk about the things that the world is interested in, and the world's interested in money and sex and power. But so often, Christians, we can just mimic those same things. We're hardly being any different in the ones we're tempted by and easily led astray by too. Well, the first thing we see in this passage is God's disobedient people. And then we see God's holy anger. In verse 7, up on the mountain, God knows. Verse 7, the Lord says to Moses, "Get down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves." God just knows. There's not even any sort of sense that God suddenly becomes... God knows exactly what is happening at the foot of the mountain. He sees everything. He knows what they have done. And he says, "Right, Moses, get down. You can't stay here. You can't stay here in my presence. You're one of them. You're representative of the people. Go down." What does he say about the people? These people now are corrupted. It literally means gone bad, gone rancid. They've gone off, these people. They stink. Their behaviour. They've turned aside my ways, or they're going the opposite way. They're stiff-necked. They're like a donkey. You can't corral them into the right course of action. As soon as you're up here the mountain with me, Moses, they've gone completely the other way. And he calls them all the time to Moses, "Your people." God doesn't say "my people." He says to Moses, "Your people. They're your people who've done this." And what can be argued with? All of that verdict of God is spot on, isn't it? And God says, "Leave me alone," verse 10. "My anger is going to burn hot against them. I'm going to consume them. And then I'll make you, Moses, a new great nation." That's God's holy anger against sin. Moses intercedes. We'll come back to that in a moment. And then Moses and Joshua start to go down the mountain. And Moses is angry too when he sees. He was interceding before. God knew what had happened. But Moses perhaps didn't know the full extent of what happened. When Moses comes down and sees what is happening, he's angry too, verse 19. And he throws the Ten Commandments down on the floor. The Ten Commandments are broken. So symbolic, that gesture too, isn't it? of what's happened. All of these things they said in chapter 20, we will do it. They have not. It's only taken them a month and a half to break it. It's all gone. This covenant, this agreement that they've made with God, they haven't kept to their terms of it, even for a couple of weeks. There they are. Chaos in the camp. Drunken revelry, out of control, idol worship that is happening. And we see God's anger. Moses calls in verse 25 for those who are of the Lord to come to him, and the tribe of Levi do. And he says it's God's command to go and kill those who won't stop. Those who won't stop this disobedience. And so they go through the camp and kill 3,000 people. 3,000 people. How much bloodshed does it take before people start screaming? Before people go, what on earth's going on? Before people wake up from their drunken hangovers and the things they've been doing. There it is. The horror that comes upon those who are disobeying God. Too drunk to notice it. What's happening in the rest of it? And then Moses also says he took the calf, verse 20, and ground it up and pours it into water and makes them drink it. They have to drink this gold dust in water. It must have tasted foul. There's warnings too of more punishment and a plague that comes. We're told, verse 34, God says, nevertheless, in the day when I visit for punishment, I will visit punishment upon them for their sin. It says in verse 35, so the Lord plagued the people. We don't really know many more details than that. Whether it's something that happened right there and then in those moments, or it's something that happened later and it's just put in here. Sort of complete the chapter, as it were. And of course, of all of those who did participate in this, none of them did get to the promised land, if you know what happens next in the story. So maybe, again, that's part of the judgment for this that happens here too. And there's this very sad phrase, isn't there? When God says in verse 33, the Lord said to Moses, whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Those who sin are blotted out of his book. In the New Testament, there's a reference to the Lamb's Book of Life. Well, that's the book that brings life and gives life. If they're blotted out of it, they receive death. Not just physical death, but eternal death and hell. That's what they have. And in chapter 33, God says to Moses how he's going to send them on to the promised land. But he says, I will not be there in your midst. Chapter 33, verse 3. The plans for the tabernacle are put on hold. There is no, it's just, you're going to head on now, off you go, to the promised land. Yeah, I'll make sure you get there. But I can't come and live with you, says God. I can't. Oh, I'll consume you on the way. It's just impossible that I, a holy God, can go with you, people, anymore. That's what's happening. And so there we have this revelation of God's anger against his own people, the Israelites. And again, it's there for us. It's there for us to take a warning too. For as we have in the New Testament too, the wages of sin is death, isn't it? For all who break God's commandment. This is not some Old Testament thing. It's there in the New Testament too. If we do not live in God's ways, the wages is death. It's appointed for men to die once and then to face judgment. Again, it says in the New Testament, not just death, but hell, eternal death, separation from God. And you see that sort of pictured here at the mountain, how God says he's got to be separate from the people. That's what hell is, to be completely separate from God, to be completely consumed by his anger. That's what we'll face. Jesus uses some very similar words in some of his parables to warn about the consequences of rejecting him. He talks about a fire that never goes out, God's anger that burns and things like that. Jesus uses the same phrases in the Gospels. What about for us, even as Christians? For those of us who know forgiveness of Jesus. Sometimes we make it too cheap. Do we sometimes just say, oh, it's no big deal. If I do this, break a little command or two, oh, God will forgive me. It's no big deal. And sometimes God gives to us that bitter aftertaste, like that gold water that they drink. Sometimes it's like that when we as Christians do something we know deep down we shouldn't, but we're so captivated with it at the time we do it anyway. And then we realise that the taste in our mouth, the bitterness that comes with it, and we're thinking, oh, we shouldn't have. What a mess. What did that ever bring? And there we are, facing God's anger. But lastly then, in this chapter we see God's gracious mediator. And there's Moses. Now it's important to get Moses in the right light here. It's not that God is really, really angry, although he is, and Moses is the calm, kind one who makes God change his mind. That isn't exactly what's happening. God has called Moses and put him there in this place for this purpose. God has chosen Moses way before, many chapters before, for this purpose of bringing the Israelites to him there on the same mountain where he met him in the burning bush. God chose Moses to lead the people and to be that mediator between God and the people. That's what is going on here. This is God's gracious mediator. This isn't really Moses' own initiative. That's the whole purpose God has put him there for. Sometimes we might look at a couple of pairs of different words and think here of God being angry and holy and just. And Moses, on the other hand, he's the one who's merciful, kind and gracious. But that isn't what it is at all. Sometimes people also project that into the New Testament and do the same thing between, as in forming a tension between Jesus and God. They say, oh, well, God is angry and holy and just, and Jesus is the one who's merciful, kind and gracious. But it's more than that. God is both. God is both angry and merciful, holy and kind, just and gracious. And God has put Moses there for this purpose. And that's why Moses is there, to vocalize these things, which he's going to do in a moment. He's just going to, in a sense, repeat God's words back to God so that we might understand the process. Otherwise, if we just have at the beginning of the chapter, God was angry, and then he said a couple of verses, and now I'm not, we'd be clueless as to what was going on. But by Moses making this function as a mediator, he's going to show us how God's anger can turn to grace, so we could understand that it's there for our benefit too. So Moses speaks to God of God's truth. Verse 11, he says, Lord, why does your wrath burn against your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt? He's the one who puts all the yous back in the sentence. He says, these are your people. You've brought them. You're the one who's rescued them out of Egypt. Verse 12, what about your reputation and glory? If you just wipe them all out now, what will the Egyptians say? What will the other nations say? They won't understand anything of your purposes, what you're doing with these people and why this has happened. What about your covenant and your promise? You said to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Israel, so you made a promise to them. Now, God knows all those things. God does not forgotten them. God does not need the reminder. But I said, we do need the reminder. The Israelites needed the reminder. That's why it's all written down. It's echoed here. It's written out here so we understand. Why did God relent? Why did God show mercy? Because of his promise. Because of his glory. Because of his character. Because of his love for his people. That's why God relents here. It's not that he suddenly changed his mind because he'd forgotten those things and Moses has to remind him. It's playing it out so we can hear it. Moses is sort of functioning almost as a sounding board, so we hear God's words sort of echoing back from him. That's Moses' purpose here. But credit to him, Moses is a remarkable guy in this. God promises I could make you a great nation, I'll wipe out the rest, and yet from you will become a great nation. Moses never mentions that. Never mentions that at all. You know, it might have been a temptation or what have you. And Moses makes an astonishing suggestion after he's been back down to the Israelites. He comes, goes back up, verse 30, and he says, "You've committed a great sin," he says to the people, "so I will go to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin." Perhaps. It's a bit of a question at this point. God had made various sacrifices and various rules of things like that, but not for something like this. What could happen? And Moses says, well, perhaps. Perhaps I can make atonement. Look at the word, at-one-ment. Maybe I can make you at one with God. Maybe I can make peace between you and God. Maybe some way to reconcile you, to make you righteous in his sight. That's all behind that idea of using of atonement. But Moses doesn't quite know how it's going to happen. And so he says to them, Moses then comes to the Lord and says, the people, verse 31, have committed a great sin and made for themselves a god of gold. Yet now, even if you would forgive their sin, but if not, I pray, blot me out of your book which you've written. Moses suggests, what if he died? What if God's punishment fell on him and he was blotted out of the book, suffering eternal death and punishment, so they wouldn't have to? Moses makes an astonishing suggestion there, doesn't he? But God says no. God says no. Whoever sinned, he'll be blotted out. Moses makes an astonishing suggestion as a prophet almost, but he can't do it. Moses can't do it. He can't die for the people. He's sinless in this situation of not making a golden calf, but he's certainly not sinless. He can't do it. And so you're left with a little bit of a question in this chapter. Well, how could it happen? How can it actually be resolved? There's a bit of a tension here in the book of Exodus. Well, how is God going to carry on with these people when there's clearly no real mechanism for fixing this situation? Of course, it points us forward to the New Testament, doesn't it? As you said, for the time being, the tabernacle's on hold. And instead, in chapter 33, Moses goes and pitches a tent far outside the camp. And that's where God is going to meet. That's where God's going to meet his people. So there still is a place to meet God, but he can't be there in the middle like the tabernacle was meant to be. Now it's outside. And Moses goes out and the people watch him go out every day. And Joshua, this chap who keeps getting a little mention here and there, he lives there. He lives there in this tent outside the camp. And one last thing, just as we bring things to a close, this all gets referred to in Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 13, it says this in verse 12, "Therefore Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. Therefore let us go forth to him outside the camp, bearing his reproach." In Hebrews, this is all compared to Jesus. Again, we said there in Exodus, there isn't really an answer for how this could exactly be sorted out at all. And in Hebrews, he says, of course. And we in the New Testament would see perhaps a little bit more of that. Of course, it could only happen through Jesus. Moses makes a suggestion, could I die for the people? God says, no. But Moses has kind of hit the nail on the head, hasn't he? That is going to be what is going to happen. But only God himself can provide the one who can be that substitute. Jesus who would come. And he sanctified the people with his own blood, with his own death. He suffered outside the camp. Jesus is the one who can make atonement, that at-one-ment, that peace with God, that forgiveness for sins, so that we won't suffer death and punishment. It falls on Jesus instead. And he's the one who suffers outside the camp. And so what do we have to do? In Exodus 33, we're told in verse 7 that Moses pitched this tent outside the camp, and everyone who sought the Lord went out to this tent. Anyone there in the camp who truly was filled with repentance, they could go out the camp to that tent, pitched outside, and seek God there, even if it quite wasn't said how exactly it would work. That's what they could do. And the writer of Hebrews says, and that's what we do as Christians. We go out the camp. In the camp. In the human race. It's just a mess. Mess of sin. There's no hope. There's no answers at all. In ourselves, inside, there's no hope. There's no answers here either. We go out. We go out the camp to Jesus. And that might mean we suffer reproach. Whether that was the case in the people of Exodus, whether there were those who went out and went out, what are they up to? Laughing at them. They went out to seek God. And as they sought him, he could be found there in that tent. And so sometimes perhaps we might face the same thing as we turn away from the idols of this world and turn to Jesus. We might be laughed at too. They might laugh at us and wonder what we're up to. But we know where the hope lies. Not in the camp, not in the human race or anything that could be conjured up here. Our hope's in Christ. We go out to that one who suffered, who gave his own blood to reconcile us, to forgive us for our disobedience and our breaking of God's laws, who can rescue us from God's judgment. God's gracious mediator, the Lord Jesus Christ.